This conversation with the neuroscientist Oliver Sacks was recorded in 2007.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum with Dr. Oliver Sacks. His new book of marvels is called Musicophilia. I'm Christopher Lydon, constant reader and boundless admirer of Oliver Sacks. He is a completely extraordinary character, starting with the fact that we think of Oliver Sacks as a writer, stylist, an inventor of a new form of literature, scientist reporting, reflection, inquiry. He thinks of himself as a doctor, a clinician, going faithfully to his nursing home patients, his hospital, his referrals of exotic cases, and then this vast correspondence with people who write and report their symptoms to him. His genius, as you all know, is mediating between the extraordinarily rare cases. I mean, how many men do we know who mistook their wife for a hat? And that normal universal. And so he has done again on the matter of music. He writes well into this book, "Music, uniquely among the arts, is both completely abstract and profoundly emotional. It has no power to represent anything particular or external, but it has a unique power to express inner states or feelings. Music can pierce the heart directly. It needs no mediation. One does not have to know anything about Dido and Aeneas to be moved by her lament for him. Anyone who has ever lost someone knows what Dido is expressing. And there is finally a deep and mysterious paradox here, for while such music makes one experience pain and grief more intensely, it brings solace and consolation at the same time." Oliver Sacks. With great pleasure, it's a privilege to introduce Oliver Sacks, but to ask him at the outset sort of the Cole Porter question, what is this thing called music? Or in the Raymond Carver mode, what do we talk about when we talk about music?
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a pleasure being here, although the ecclesiastical atmosphere makes me oscillate between feelings of reverence and blasphemy. Now, I do in fact start my book with the question which Chris raises, although I put it into the mouth of some Martians or science fiction supermen who are described in the Arthur Clarke book Childhood's End. These highly cerebral super beings come down to Earth, and amongst other things, they attend a concert, and they listen with great patience and courtesy. They congratulate the composer on his great ingenuity, but they have no idea what went on. Rather than try and answer your question, when you asked your question, I found myself thinking of the lines from Eliot, "Do not ask what is it, let us go and make our visit." And basically, my sort of writing is to give examples. I really don't have much in the way of definitions or systems or general theories. I think I'm going to speak for about 5 minutes, and then we'll chat together. I suspect I was introduced to music in utero, because the household was full of music. My older brothers were learning the piano and the clarinet and the flute, and there was chamber music, and especially Bach. And when I was five and I was asked what were my favorite things in the world, I said smoked salmon and Bach. I had some smoked salmon at lunch today. 70 years later, things may not have changed that much. But to go back to the quote, I was always doubly tantalized by music. First of all, by its patterns, its symmetries, its proportions, its mathematical perfection and abstractness, and second, by the excruciating pleasure which it could produce, and the sweet pain which was beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond expression by anything else. As a physician, I re-encountered music 40 years ago or so when I met the deeply disabled people whom I later described in Awakenings, these deeply Parkinsonian people who often couldn't initiate a single movement or sound by themselves, but who could be liberated by music in the most amazing way. I once took W.H. Auden, whom I knew in his later days, to see the music sessions with these patients. I took him partly because he was so musical. He wrote the libretto to The Magic Flute and lots of things, and also because his father, George Auden, had been one of the great describers of the sleepy sickness in England in the 1920s. And Auden was amazed when he saw this, and he quoted an aphorism of Novalis, which is, every disease is a musical problem and every cure is a musical solution. This seemed perfectly to fit what was going on there, although I think it's only metaphorical for other things. And then over the years, I saw the great therapeutic power of music with patients of other sorts, those with amnesia, with dementia, with aphasia, with autism, etc. I also encountered, as a physician, people with various musical problems, some of a negative sort and some of a positive sort. The negative sort were that people would sometimes, after a stroke or a head injury, lose the ability to perceive some aspect of music. The tone, the rhythm, the pitch, the melodic contour, whatever it was. Or sometimes they would perceive music accurately but lose their emotional response to it, but not their emotional response to anything else. And this showed me that there's no one part of the brain which responds to music, but there are many, many parts of the brain, many different networks. Music, in fact, occupies much more of the brain than language or almost anything else, even though it seems to be an exclusively human thing. I know I will be attacked by whale and bird song people for saying that. The other problem, which I believe is not uncommon, has to do with musical hallucinations. I wrote about these in my Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat book, and this sort of opened the floodgates. Many people wrote to a columnist called Dear Abby saying, yes, they too had musical hallucinations. They said it was, they'd never mentioned it to their husband and wife. They were afraid it might connote something awful. They'd been to their doctor, who had ignored them. And then Dear Abby asked me if I would comment on these letters. And rightly or wrongly, I did so. And since this time, I've had a Niagara of letters. I would think close to 1,000. And so I think that has been a special sort of problem. So I've written odds and ends about music over the years, but basically since 1990 or so, neuroscience for the first time has interested itself in music. And most of the neuroscientists who study music are themselves good musicians. So they know music both from the inside and the outside. And there are several of them as a start right here at Harvard. Gottfried Schlaug, Mark Tremo, Alvaro Pascaglione, and others. So this, in fact, has been a hot spot for looking at music in the brain right here. And in the book, I've somehow tried to couple my what for me is I'm an incontinent storyteller. I can't stop it, and it's but a lot of medicine consists of stories. People tell me their stories, they give me their lives, and a narrative is an essential part. But then, unlike a novelist, one also, though perhaps it's a bit more like a detective story, you have to ask what's going on in the person. Anyhow, I've tried to put things together in the book, and I've said my 5 minutes, and now I'll sit down. Or rather, you will stand up.
You remind me, speaking of cognitive science, you represent a sort of convergence between two aphorisms. Walter Pater, 100 years ago maybe, said that all art aspires to the condition of music. And more recently, Marjorie Garber said that all learning now, all university disciplines aspire to the condition of cognitive science. So here you are at the crossroads. I'll tell you where I'm going. I want to ask you sort of three different questions. Or would you expand on three different points? One, the evolution of music, music in evolution. Is it an accident? Is it essential? Secondly, I'd like you to expand on the matter of music as therapy and how it works. And then I'm interested in the question of music as transcendence, and music as the language of eternity, God's sound, or however we want to phrase it. But would you first just talk about the evolutionary significance of this uniquely human thing? Or as Steve Pinker says, non-significance.
As a clinician, I can only really address the middle question, but I'll have a go at all of them. There have been all sorts of theories and speculations about the origin of music and language and their interactions, at least since the time of Rousseau, who was a composer as well as a writer, and who felt that there had been originally some primal form of expression or discourse which was articulate music, something which was inseparably music and language, and that this then bifurcated or differentiated. Good to jump. William James, whom I adore, in fact he was called at Harvard that adorable genius, but in the 1,500 pages of the Principles of Psychology, there is one sentence, and that rather dismissive, about music. When he speaks of the susceptibility to music, he says it has no zoological utility, and it is a pure incident of having a hearing organ, he says, like the susceptibility to seasickness. this tone is echoed, if I don't do him an injustice, by Steven Pinker, who has sometimes spoken of music as auditory cheesecake, this to be contrasted with man does not live by bread alone, and similarly has spoken of an absence of biological relevance, and has said that if music disappeared, it would make no difference to us. I disagree passionately there, and I think as a start one would have to explain why music exists and is central in every culture known to us and occupies so many roles, from religious music to martial music to dancing to every sort of music, and why, going back, one can find, say, bone flutes 50,000 years old, which have tonal intervals somewhat similar to our own. Steven Pinker and I think William James regard music as a sort of trivial appendage to speech. But there are some aspects of music which have no analog in speech, and one would have to explain how they could occur. And the clearest one of these, and again uniquely human, is the way in which we all tap or dance or keep time to sound. We keep the pulse, we keep the beat. And even if even if we don't do, and this occurs spontaneously in all children, but you never see a dancing monkey or a dancing chimpanzee. It depends on anatomical connections unique to the human brain between the auditory and motor parts of the brain. Darwin has a whole chapter about the evolution of music. He thought that it had arisen as part of courtship rituals, but not merely as a fixed code, such as you have with birds, but as a potential for expression beyond any other. He thought that language was secondary to it. What do I know? I can only quote these people. But then what do they know? No one was around. I'm afraid I haven't got past the first question.
No, I just add that Daniel Levitin, and you know him and you cite him, but he makes what seem perfectly obvious points. Not only music is intimately associated with intimacy, with courtship, with sex, with love, with romantic love. I mean, it's in there in the biological chain. But it also, he writes, among other things, that skill at music betokens leisure, betokens wealth, betokens mating attractiveness. I mean, it would seem to be threaded through every aspect of evolution, to my logical eye. And I guess you come out the same place.
Of course, Darwin links it explicitly to sexual selection, but I also think of it as a sort of social cement, which is, you know, we couldn't do without.
And now I have a different question of the matter of transcendence and sort of the music of the spheres, the ultimate music. This is from your friend and mine, Proust, and in The Captive, he listens again to the latest Venturi piece, and he's just reflecting, but he says, he's talking with other people. People are chattering around him, and he says, "But what were their words, which, like every human and external word, left me so indifferent compared with the heavenly phrase of music with which I had just been communing? I wondered," here's the question, "I wondered whether music might not be the unique example of what might have been if the invention of language, the formation of words, the analysis of ideas had not intervened, whether it might have been the means of communication between souls."
That's wonderful. I wish I'd put that in the book.
Well, the second edition.
Yeah. And that from such a master of language as Proust. Language of the heart, language of souls. There's part of me which sort of rebels against words like the heart and the soul and transcendence, and yet one can't avoid them. Interestingly, William James, to come back to him, never uses the term soul in the Principles of Psychology, but he continually used it in conversational correspondence, and of course he uses it at Central in the Varieties of Religious Experience.
Get uninhibited now on the language of, the ultimate mystery. Proust is also asking, what if language were not invented and we just sang to each other, we just danced for each other, or played fiddles for each other or something?
I don't think there's any universal music. Some things are universal. Every culture will agree about octaves and certain divisions of octaves, and these correspond to mathematical proportions. But for example, we think of major keys as jolly and minor ones as sad. You go back 800 years and it may be the other way around. You think of, say, Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. This is a very upbeat piece in a minor key, except for a sad portion which is in a major key. There are stories that sort of pygmies in the rainforest hearing Mozart for the first time weep. These are very affecting stories. I don't know if they're true.
I want to believe them.
I want to believe them. And in fact, I think I took a little bit of license in that sentence of mine you read out where I said I think I wrote something about music not needing any mediation. I think it does need mediation. Everything needs mediation. But it's a very strange sort of mediation with music, and it's like nothing else.
You know the therapy of music so well. I simply wonder, and we all have experienced changes of mood, changes of lifting of depression. I think of my mother. The last time I saw my mother, she was on the verge of 93, and she had lost a great deal of memory. But I said, Mom, she was always a wonderful singer, and I said, let's sing some of the old songs. And she dismissed some of them. She dismissed Care Selvi, of all things, as sort of an insignificant song. But when I mentioned Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes, she said, now there's a good song. She sang it in perfect pitch, all the words. I mean, they came from somewhere. And at the end of it, she said two things. One, those were marvelous times we lived in. And second was a question, what happened? But it had this power coming entirely from her to restore a fullness of life. I'm sure you've lived thousands of examples of this, but what is your sense of what's happening inside a person who's being transformed in some basic, complicated, complete way by harmony, memory, rhythm, all the emotion that comes with it?
I think you're bringing up at least two points, if not more, here. One has to do with the ability of people, even when they've lost so much of their memory and maybe so much of their mental powers in other ways, to recognize music and respond to it and perhaps perform it. In reductive neurological terms, I think this is because music which one has learned well, and not only music, but anything which one has learned well and which has become, in a sense, sort of automatic, although I hesitate to use the word, no longer depends on the cerebral cortex, on the higher parts of the brain. It has got locked away in the cerebellum, the basal ganglia, the lower parts, which are still intact. But all of the emotions and feelings and thoughts and memories which were associated with the music are also locked away. So one really has this indestructible treasure of familiar music and familiar poetry, which I think in a way is there forever. But as you say, it comes from the heart, and one can't reduce the heart to the basal ganglia or anything like this. One responds to music in one's wholeness. One recovers identity. One discovers and recovers identity, I think, very, very completely with music. But then your question also becomes, how do we respond? Why do we respond to art? What the hell is it about? What does it do? And I don't know.
I'd remind you, you're joining us at the Cambridge Forum, listening to Oliver Sacks on the subject of his new book, Musicophilia. Welcome to Cambridge Forum with Dr. Oliver Sacks. We're continuing a conversation around his book, Musicophilia, on the intimate relationship between music and the human brain. I want to just tell you very briefly something that happened, and I'll never forget it. When we were making television, we did a long piece on two long pieces completely unconnected on two wood engravers who lived in New England, Fritz Eichenberg in Rhode Island and Leonard Baskin in Western Massachusetts.
I knew him well, yeah.
Interesting men.
Shortly.
Both interesting men. They didn't like each other, and they practiced the same, you know, carving on end grain boxwood, the same thing. But in the end, when I was finishing editing the piece on Fritz Eichenberg, I called him in a panic. I said, "Fritz, we never spoke about it. What's the music of this piece that we should use for introduction?" And he said, as if he'd been waiting for me to ask him, he said, "Well, of course, it's the last song in the Schubert cycle, Die Winterreise, the hurdy-gurdy man who is going out into the snow, into death, into chaos," and he saw himself that way. Several years later, we did this piece on Leonard Baskin, and the same moment came, and I thought, why hadn't I thought of this? I called him. I said, "Leonard, what's the music of this piece?" And he, again, it was as if I'd been waiting for you to call. He said, "Well, obviously, it's the Schubert posthumous sonata in B-flat, the one that sounds like, 'Oh, come all you faithful,' and it goes off." And I thought, now this is telling me something. This is the music of eternity. It's the music of artists who've reflected on everything, who are ready for the end. And in a certain sense, the end is revealed by these unbelievable pieces. How do you account for that? I wish they were... I wish you were there. They were your patients.
Well, certainly, I myself respond to Schubert, to all of Schubert, but especially a lot of the songs, more than anything else, in a very different way when I had got into a frozen state after the death of my mother. Mm. And I'd moved from mourning into some sort of numb state. Hearing some very different Schubert, not the Winterreise, but the earlier cycle, which was full of joy, that suddenly reminded me of good things in life and of being alive, and I wanted to stay with it, but it was music coming out of a basement window, and I had to walk away. But I felt I had to have more Schubert, and then I heard that Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau was going to be in New York and was going to be singing the Winterreise. With difficulty, I got a ticket. It may have been the wrong thing to do, because when I went there, I couldn't react to that, and or maybe the Winterreise was too desolate for someone who was already mourning. That taught me that one can't command music. It has to come spontaneously. It has to be, you know, as clearly it did to your two artists for whom it was an immediate answer. I mean, late Schubert is about, maybe all music is about life and death, but late Schubert, he was a young man. He knew he was fatally ill. But nonetheless, I'm not sure that, I don't think music can represent anything outside oneself or anything universal. But it's interesting that these two men who were so different and who disliked each other both homed in on Schubert and late Schubert.
I'm sure you know that that posthumous piano sonata, and I won't sing it, but it does feel like the music of, you know, beyond galaxies. And I wonder if there's any, from a neurologist tools, is there any accounting for what's going on?
I had a dream the other night, and dreams one escapes from the shackles of one's own reason and reductionism. And I, in my dream, I dreamt some foray. I didn't know what it was, though when I woke up I realized it was his Requiem. But this, in fact, went with a vision of star nurseries, the sort of things which the Hubble reveals, and galaxies being formed. I don't like words like the beyond or eternal, but maybe one can't avoid them. I may soften up here, but I'm just I'm not sure what to say. I want to come back to your previous thing. And again, you know, my feet are. I'm narrowly, childishly planted in the clinical. I can't talk about transcendence and galaxies. You know, I think of my patients. Now, one of who on the whole do not speak in cosmic terms, but a not uncommon coupling, for example, is of people who see color when they listen to music. Mm. They see colors. Sometimes, if they have absolute pitch, it will be associated with the particular key, but it may also be associated with the pattern, the rhythm, the mood, the melody, whatever. People who have this assume it's universal. When I met the composer Michael Torkey, he described his synesthesia, how when he was 5 years old, he said to his piano teacher, "I love that blue piece." And his piano teacher said, "Blue?" He said, yeah, D major, blue. And his piano teacher said, "Not for me." And he said...
I would have said D major is green, actually.
This
B flat is blue.
He was very shocked that the piano teacher didn't, you know, he assumed it was universal. But 10 years later, he met someone like you who did have a tone color synesthesia, and he thought they were going to be brothers, but the other man disagreed with him. This is what happened with Scriabin and Rimsky-Korsakov, who were both... Now, this is very real, and you can show that the color-constructing parts of the brain are activated at the same moment as various auditory parts. This is not metaphor. And there's some very strange things which metaphor couldn't deal with. So, for example, when Michael Torkey talked about, I think it was G-sharp minor, he says yellow. No, not yellow, ochre. Yeah, not ochre, gamboge. And then what he would bring out was, in fact, he could not say the color. It was unlike anything he had seen. And my colleague Ramachandran in La Jolla has described synesthesia with some colorblind people who say that when they're synesthetically stimulated, they may see colors they've never seen and which they call Martian colors. Mm. Whereas Locke and other and such philosophers thought there was nothing in the mind which hadn't come from the senses, I think there can be things in the mind, starting with color, which don't come from the senses. And this goes right up to heaven, yeah, which isn't in the senses.
I wanted to pick up on something else there. I mean, in the book you write that some people see colors, other people get tastes. A major sixth interval is a salty dollar, taste,
yeah, right, yeah.
And a minor sixth may be sweet or whatever. Yeah.
There's a suggestion, and more than a suggestion, there's some evidence that all of us, have a fusion or confusion or undifferentiation of the senses in the first year of life, or certainly the first months of life. And then in most people, things differentiate out and it stops. But in the people with synesthesia, this isn't so.
Could I ask you, I mean, there's the transcendence question, but then now go back to the clinical brain activity with a love song, say, with a could be Sinatra, could be folk melody, but, you know, that's basically about those famous real emotions. What's going on there?
One can show, if you do functional brain imaging, very specific responses in the brain to music which makes one swoon.
Someone to whisper, darling, you're my guiding star.
This has particularly been looked at by a man called Zator up in Montreal, and he speaks of chills in music, music which makes one's hair stand on end. I had this yesterday when I listened to part of Yenufa, this mysterious, uncanny opera of Janáček, which had overwhelmed me when I heard it about 18 months ago, and it overwhelmed me again. When this happens, all parts of the brain light up, which also light up in love, in orgasm, and with certain drugs, and which are rather dryly called reward systems of the brain. Reward is a very dry term to use, although I want to correlate and say that, you know, you get your reward in heaven. The reward, in fact, is a sort of heavenly sensation. It's also a terrifying one. But it's the sensation, if you want, of transcendence, of surrender. Freud would call it oceanic. And whether you see it as regression to something primitive or elevation to something higher, it's probably not uniquely human. In fact, I'm sure it's not. I mean, why else would animals reproduce or do anything? I mean, it's the great motivator of human life. But certainly music can do it.
Third kind of music I'd like you to just speak about, and that is, I'm thinking of Afro-Cuban music, percussive, incredibly complex, or Ghanaian drumming, or whatever, that makes our Western tonal 4-4 or 3-4 music seem almost childishly simple. What's our brain doing when we hear Afro-Cuban jazz?
I again have to confess my own narrowness, and that I was brought up in, you know, for me, music is roughly sort of Monteverdi to Shostakovich, whatever. Obviously, in the sort of polyrhythmic music you describe, there is a rhythmic complexity beyond anything in Western European music. On the other hand, there's a relative absence of harmony and melodic simplicity. I don't know that one can make any value judgments, but in general, the brain is more equipped to deal with rhythm than with tonality. Pitch discrimination and tonality can be lost fairly easily with various diseases or damage. One never loses the sense of rhythm, and rhythm is sort of primordial. I think of a passage in St. Augustine and the Confessions, where Augustine has a young priest, a rather prissy young man, rather inhibited as well, who comes along with him to a gladiatorial contest and is sort of rather sniffy and supercilious, until the crowd bursts into a rhythmic chanting, and then the young man is carried away and he can't stop himself joining in. I mean, I think the origin of music, original music, is rhythm, and this is what started up in the human brain 500,000 years ago, and it's and it will finally outlast everything else. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Oliver Sacks.